Ladies and gentlemen, Kirk Thatcher and Darren Doctorman, the Weirded Beardos.
And we're back. It's the Weirded Beardos. I'm Darren Doctorman. This is Kirk Thatcher. And we have a special guest. We have our first special guest, which is very exciting.
Yes. Who has a beard.
Who has a beard. Yeah. I mean, that's beard. That's the requirements.
Yes.
So I'm pretty far beardo.
Fellow beardo, Alan Monroe, who is a director, producer, a visual effects supervisor, a storyboard artist, an artist, a
weirdo.
A layabout.
And a hell of a merengue dancer, I'm told.
Yes. Well,
that's meringue.
Both, actually.
Welcome to the Beardos. We had a little bit of a snag this morning trying to get the
don't call it that.
The computers to work, but we're
here. My tin can is tied to a string now.
So nice. Good.
We're fully communicating.
Pull it taut.
From the treehouse now I can hear.
Marvelous. Well, so, welcome to our little corner of nothing.
I see that, and a fine corner it is. I'm trying to make out everything in the background of your.
Oh yeah, we've got a.
The last time it was a beach, so.
Yes. We change it up. I'm broadcasting from my living room and living from my broad room.
like a French bronze or something.
It's actually a ceramic. It's an Austrian ceramic from the turn of. Yeah.
A 19th century, like Austrian.
Yeah, Goldscheider. I'm a fan of, an aficionado of the Art Nouveau style. So.
Yes, as am I.
Oh, well, yeah. Alan, welcome. Yes. So your career sounds very much like our careers, like under the umbrella of I do art.
Maybe more so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So since Darren knows you, so usually, yeah, I think most of our guests, at least in this first year, are going to be people that we've worked with or know who are in the biz. I will have him field the questions because I'm like, so what do you do?
Kirk. Well, having listened, by the way, you know, I realized with you, you know, my sort of Muppets adjacent connection is I used to be quite good friends with Lyle Conway.
Oh, yeah.
Very well. And the other strange connection in all of this is I actually knew Val Kilmer's dad. I knew Gene Kilmer.
How did you know Gene?
Well, I knew Gene Kilmer, and I also know that Gene Kilmer had a replica of the Hannibal 8.
And that's for Wesley, his son, who was my best friend.
Which I have seen.
Yeah.
And how this happened is that I was working with Danny Lee.
Danny Lee, yeah.
The sadly passed on, but fabulous special effects band, one of the greats of all history.
Yeah.
Had a shop in Chatsworth.
Yes.
A huge shop because, and which I believe
Gene
had financed.
Well, I think it was Gene's built. Gene owned a bunch of real estate in Chatsworth.
Yes, exactly.
We used to go visit it and just see how's the Hannibal 8 coming? And, you know, sitting in and work the cannon and yeah.
Yeah.
But wait, did you work on that?
So no, I worked. I when I was at Canon in the visual effects department, the visual effects department was myself and like two other people. We leased out Danny's space we worked out of Danny's space.
For
over a year. So I worked on Invaders from Mars. Did stuff there. And that's the Toby Hooper.
The remake, yes.
Not William Cameron Menzies.
Menzies, right.
Stan Winston made the creatures and Bill Stout designed them. And yeah.
But yeah, wait, that one.
Was Hal Bigger working there anymore? He was part of Danny's crew working on Hannibal 8.
No. That had long been done, and he knew I was a fan of, I would talk to Danny endlessly about his former resume.
Right. Well, the
only person who actually knew, what the hell any of that stuff was. And so I was like asking him about the Great Race, and he just sort of, because I posited actually to Danny that, of course, the Hannibal 8 didn't actually fully work, because you never actually see it fully in frame do its thing. And he said, the hell it doesn't actually work.
It drove.
Not only does it work, I will. And he took me out. He showed me his jeans, and he was out there, and I got to talk to him a bit. Interestingly enough, the thing I always remember is him saying, we were talking about being in the movies. Blah, blah, blah. He says, oh, I got a son. He's trying to break into the.
So this had to be 75, 76.
No. This would be the early 80s.
Oh, wow. Because Wesley had passed in 77.
Well, him I didn't.
He's gone. So you were talking about Val. Okay.
Yeah. And Gene is dad. And so.
Yeah. And Mark was the oldest.
Yeah. But I never met either. I only met.
I met Gene. Yeah. My dad was Gene's lawyer, because they met, through I went to school with his sons, and my dad ended up representing him and represented the estate when Gene passed, and which was the Roy Rogers estate. It was this big chunk of land out in Chatsworth. And now it's like super high. Yeah.
That's one of the reasons we used to we shot the on Invaders from Mars, we filmed the Saturn V blowing up on the gantry out on Gene's back 40.
Up in the mountain.
Actually, there was a huge wildfire going on, and we actually got worried because it was the dead of night, but it was actually making so much ambient red orange in the sky.
But it made great smoke for your. So how did you get started in where, let's go with the, all that's so inside baseball.
I think that you're stealing my questions now. Thank you, Kirk. Okay. Thank you very much. Go ahead. Ask your question.
Go ahead. Like I said, you were starting to talk about, I was listening to this. I had that moment of like, oh my God,
There's very, very little separation of the degrees.
Yes. When Gene Kilmer becomes dad becomes the
pivot point.
Danny Lee is the nodal point. Yeah, that's a small.
Yeah.
Where'd you grow up? How'd you get in the biz?
Tell us now.
It kind of really starts. I came down here to LA to go to school at Art Center College of Design.
Oh yeah.
And I was actually my major. I was actually training to be an illustrator, but at the same time, even while I was still going to school, there were guys that were sort of doing movie jobs and. Okay, so cut to while I'm there, I quit after just a couple of years, and I'm doing illustration work, but it's all movie advertising related. So I worked on like Oh God and My Bodyguard and all kinds of Metal Storm. And so partially during all of that, I was intersecting with I guess By the way, my most famous aspect of this, if you've ever seen the movie Galaxy of Terror, or know of the movie
Sure.
Galaxy of Terror, and know of the one sheet.
Yes.
Okay.
Chris
It says
Whaler.
char, it actually the signature is Charo, and that's actually myself and now I'm blanking on.
Wow. So you're around like Charlie White the Third while Drew
So,
Struzan was booming and
any yeah, all of that
yeah.
stuff, right? Okay. Anyway, so I was also intersecting at that point with like New World and Corman and all of those guys because they actually did their own ad work directly. And so through basically, oh, I know what I was going to say. Okay, so the other guy I was doing that with was a guy named Paul Chadwick, who ended up doing a very famous dark horse comic called Concrete. So I was, and I was living in a building. We were all lived in this building called the Golden Palm. And everybody who was living in this building is a total pest hole in Highland Park. But everybody in the building was sort of in the trying to break into the business and in the business. And there was like a writer, a guy named Mark Verheiden, who was there, who did a lot of comic stuff. There was Paul, there was a guy named Ron Harris, and through Ron Harris, I actually ghosted a bunch of Star Trek comic work.
The newspaper strip.
Yeah, the newspaper strip, because Ron was doing the strip, and so I used to help him do the Star Trek strip.
Wow.
And anyway, so there was many a we were kind of all working on all of this crazy stuff together, and it was all kind of intersecting. And mostly, Paul Chadwick was doing movie work, although there was two other guys. Jim Gurney, the guy who did Dinotopia, he was also there, and he was actually doing stuff with Fire and Ice. I can't think of Ralph Bakshi. So
Actually, yeah.
yeah, so then I was sort of helping out a little bit on that stuff with Bakshi. And anyway, then oh God, what else was we were fiddling with? Like the Philadelphia Experiment, and there were that terrible Mac Davis movie, Cheaper to Keeper. Anyway,
See, saying the terrible Mac Davis movie doesn't narrow them down.
yes, exactly. So one of those, anyway, yes. Anyway, all that stuff. And so then I did a couple of God, like Hot Dog the Movie, Hamburger the Motion Picture. I did all the big food films.
So you did the, you did like was art directing the poster or actually doing the illustration and everything?
You know, I was doing storyboards, and this was all storyboard work and design work, and like the
Okay, you
Bakshi's
moved out
was
of it.
helping on matte paintings for backgrounds,
Oh,
and
wow, okay.
it was just kind of this whole weird,
Umbrella of art, yes.
yeah, just all kinds of weird stuff
Yeah.
that was going on. And by the way, just as a there again, as a total aside, Jim Gurney's roommate, upstairs neighbor, during this whole period and working with Bakshi, she was a guy named Tom Kincaid, who ended up becoming Tom Kincaid, billionaire painter of light.
Wow.
Wow. So that was this building.
Like
So we were all living,
the
you know, this
Brill
is like
Building of
literally
artists.
like in, you know, the nine apartments, this
It was
was
the art nexus.
I was gonna say the Brill Building of illustrators and artists in Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly. It was just weird because we were, nobody had any money, and we were all losers. But it was wild, right? And we were all, everybody was kind of working on everybody's stuff. So we were all kind of, that's why I was saying the Galaxy of Terror thing is actually signed Charo. That's for Chadwick and Monroe.
Oh, funny. Wow.
So because we both worked on it, and
Coochie Coochie.
Coochie Coochie, yes.
No,
And the
it was
Fabulous,
only R-rated.
Yes. Linda, the fabulous Linda Shane, who is actually the woman who posed for the woman with the ray gun. If you're a fan
of Galaxy of
a
Terror.
real aficionado of Corman films of that era.
Yes.
And of course, the art director on that show was Jim Cameron.
Yeah. Was Jim Cameron? Yes. Well, we could. That's a whole other.
That's a whole other thing.
That's a whole other universe. The weird Jim Cameron. I knew you when you were. He was the art director. He was the driver. But it's okay. He was the driver on it for the art department. But
wow.
Okay. He was the art director.
Well, when they make you do the credits, you can give yourself any credit you want.
Any credit you want. Exactly. Anyway. Yeah, that's a whole other, yeah, the New World Jim and Gail Ann Hurd was there at the time. And
yeah, it's one of those movies that half the people who work
pre, on. And pre, yeah, pre-surgery Gail was there.
Oh, dear.
Okay. Which I don't think she's one of the 40, I'm guessing, right? So
I don't know.
Okay, anyway, so all of that was going on. The kind of movie intersection thing. And then I got a job storyboarding a film for Canon Films, a very big one, a thing called Runaway Train.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of ended up being, because I was boarding it, then I was designing stuff, and then I sort of went up and kind of supervised a bunch of plate photography in Alaska, and then that turned into Canon at the same time decided to form, you know, like a visual effects department. And so I for a few years in there, I sort of became the sort of alternating. I was doing effects work for them, but then I was also like boarding and doing other things on movies. And part of it was like, I spent a lot of time in the Philippines working on things like American Ninja and Missing in Action 15. And
right.
Because I became friends with the, you know, kind of like the Israeli cadre that was sort of off making these things. And their problem was they would go, we're trying to make these American movies. Right. But there were no Americans working on these movies. So they were trying to write them and direct them. And actually, you know, English was like a third language for everybody. And so I would hang out in the Manila hotel and you'd just kind of be doing everything. Right. You'd be sort of like, OK, I'm boarding stuff. And then tomorrow I'm writing a scene for the, you know.
It was rock videos, but movies.
Yeah, you know, so buddy. it was completely nuts. And we were just doing all this stuff. And then eventually I came back and then they tried to make the department, the effects department, sort of a little more of a formal department. But it was really only like three of us. And we were just kind of doing, let's put it this way. My favorite moment, there used to be, we were all in 6464 Sunset. That was the building Canon was in, and we were variously on about four floors of the building. But in the basement was a screening room, a big one. And that's where we used to screen stuff. And from time to time, you know, Menachem, who was Yoram and Menachem, who ran the place. So Menachem Golan was, he looked like Harvey Weinstein, only more so.
Yeah.
This kind of Menachem.
Less charisma. And, yeah.
Not that there's
anyway, he would
wrong
sometimes come down and watch the stuff. We would, you know, this is back in the film days, you'd have to go down and screen the stuff we were working on. And a shot came up from, I think it was King Solomon's Mines or Alan Quatermain.
Right.
Which was admittedly pretty awful.
But they had a lot of production value.
And from the, not the, I'm just talking about the shot we had, you know, that the fabulous effects department. It was sort of less than a stunning piece of work, and as was pretty much our trademark. And from the front row, we heard Menachem boom out, "Five more like that, and you're all fired."
So you only did four more like that, and you
So
remained
we were
safe.
like, okay, so does this count?
Is this one of the five, or?
Five or
Yeah, that's
five
hilarious.
in addition to
Was it a miniature shot, or what was it?
yeah, it was it
Yeah.
still had that vague that it was a little toy.
Yeah.
It we hadn't quite
You could still smell the super glue.
you could yes yeah we were yeah it was a it was a it was a bit of a scale focus problem that was kind of making it slightly less than real, but I did happily on Alan Quatermain. I did that was my first of quite a few trips to Africa on various
That South
things.
Africa is
And that was J. Lee Thompson, you
right,
know, of
director of
Adrenaline,
Guns of Navarone
you know, Guns of Navarone.
and the last Planet of the Apes movie.
And the, yeah, exactly. And here he was, you know, out in the middle of nowhere with Richard Chamberlain
Aaron Stone.
and the fabulous Sharon Stone, who was absolutely breathtaking.
Oh, yeah.
I never got, I don't think, closer than 10 feet, but from 10 feet,
Well, that was her request.
it was with her insistence, special.
Their
You know,
contract.
and actually, it was, I got to witness one of the great directorial moments of my career as J. Lee was explaining to Richard Chamberlain that he was sort of gonna, he was running down this path, escaping the natives who were chasing him, right? And they had already planted a spear, so they were throwing spears way behind him, so they would get stuff sort of through frame. And then they were gonna wobble one in the foreground, the camera would find it, right? And the idea was that Richard Chamberlain would, you know, grab it and turn and, you know,
Chuck it.
chuck it back. Okay, so I guess I'm not talking to you far out of school to say that Richard Chamberlain is a bit fey. As how do we say this gentleman?
What?
What?
Less masculine than the average man.
Right. Yes. And so Jay Lee, he's backed up, and Jay Lee is ready. He's like, "Okay, Richard, action!" And he comes running down the path, and he stops, and the thing is like wobbling, and he's kind of a little bit waiting for it to calm down, and then he lets it again, like that. And Jay Lee goes, "Ah, oh, butch it up, Richard, butch it up."
Hilarious.
Yeah, so it's kind of my, you know, the most memorable direction I've ever.
Watch it up. It's very British too.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Sadly, he was a very nice man.
Yes. Now you're on
He was
the
a he was he was you know, alcohol had kind of ruined his
like
career.
many British actors.
And he was trying to dry out and sort of
Well,
find
that
his.
was his first mistake.
Yes. So he just kept the buzz on. Maybe
Yeah.
his career would have
Oliver
been.
Reed, Richard Harris, Peter O'Toole. I mean,
Yeah.
they were all like classic alcoholics. The thing that I remember someone telling me, they worked on Gladiator, a makeup artist over in wherever they shot it. And he said, what's his
Oliver Reed.
name? Reed would go out drinking with the grips and whoever wanted to join till like 3, 4 in the morning, and then be in the makeup chair at 6:30. I mean, almost passed out, but when he was on set, he knew his lines. Like they just rose to the occasion, but you know, had to be carted to set.
Yeah, we did the in Africa. We did the Oliver Reed thing, and that was also at a time. James Booth, I don't know if you remember. He's mostly famous. Have you ever seen the film Zulu?
Yeah.
He played Hook. He played the bad boy. He's in quite a few other films. Okay. Anyway, he sort of turned into this sort of actor, writer, quasi producer, and he was forever in South Africa. We're making all these, like, churning out all these shitty films that we didn't. Canon didn't make all the shitty ones that Canon didn't make in the Philippines. We made in South Africa. So you kind of, those were the main places that you bounced between.
Yes.
Which, by the way, were actually what that was all about. It was essentially the Canon model at the time was the same model as a variation on the Corman model, which is they would basically go to countries where there were currency restrictions. In other words, the thing about South Africa was you could only take, if you left the country, you could only take 10, I think at that point it was like 10,000 or maybe it was 20,000 in cash with you. The rest of your assets had to remain in the country, right? Okay. So
in
if you
diamonds.
Wanted to get money out of the country, how you could launder it would be, a movie company would come and you'd say, okay, you give us $1 million to make the movie and we will pay you 6 months from now, 300,000 in pound sterling in the bank of your choice somewhere else in the world.
It was a rebate.
And so they would literally, so in other words, the money that they had in the country would get spent in the country.
Right.
And then they would simply, but it was always, the deal was always just a straight cash, 30 cents on the dollar. So you would literally, you would put up $1 million. And then on the back end, they would only owe the guy 300 grand.
Wow.
So it just became this way. So that was essentially why we ended up shooting movies where we shot them in those days. It was just about the whole currency restriction thing, how to get around it.
And at that point, your effects, physical and special.
It's more visual effects than. But we're kind of doing all, you know, because it's miniature stuff, and so it's it's a kind of a mixed bag of, you know, you're like building, you're making stuff, and you're gluing Nernies on shit and putting together, you know, shitty Jeep models and.
Right. But you're doing that there, not here. You're doing.
No. And then, well, see, we would go shoot the stuff.
These
other places, and then I would, and then a lot of times I was there, like on the movie, actually, like doing storyboards and other things, not effects related. And then we would come back to LA, and then do like the effects part. So I was kind of when I was there, it was more about supervising the shooting and all that kind of stuff, and kind of doing other.
It was what we used to call filmmaking.
One
job, and you know, you had a union that controlled it, and that's all you did. It was kind of that's what I mean. It was still the Wild West.
Oh God, it was. Yeah, it was literally like you're here, you're available, and you're dumb enough to say sure. You need sure.
You'll do it for $600 a week, American money. Yeah.
So you just.
So. When did you transfer into like production design or directing or all the other things in your resume?
Okay. So I'm doing all this stuff at Canon and da 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 da. And then at the same time, and this is Paul Chadwick again. Oh, wait a second. No. I gotta think about this. Okay, there's kind of two streams. So I'm doing the Canon stuff. And then the hot dog hamburger guys, this is like Ed Feldman. And I don't know if you
knew. Edward S. Feldman.
Ed's most famous for, not only did he produce Witness, but he's the old guy who gets off the bus.
Right.
Ed Feldman.
That
there was he was set, kind of making all these weird indie movies, and I'd sort of work on those. Through that group, there was this film called The Wraith. Charlie Sheen and God, who's all in it? Nick Cassavetes and Cheryl Lynn Finn and what's his name? Ryan O'Neill's son, Griffin O'Neill, is in it. And okay,
and so Pete Caram.
Well, and that's how I met Pete. Was actually so they I was doing kind of a bunch of stuff on that same kind of drill with like shooting stuff and they had because it was a sci-fi thing, there was this whole opening effect sequence and about how the car is, it's about a car from the supernatural, whatever. And so I said, sure, I can do this sequence. And so I took charge of this sequence. And then through that was actually how I met Pete Caran, who was ex, you know, Lucas, Star Wars, you know, kind of like one of the original recipe guys on that. So that's how I started working for Pete. Now, also at that time, that they were the same company that was doing that was working on a film called the, I think it was called The Gate.
The Gate, right?
Which was Randy Cook.
Randy Cook, Greg Reardon, yeah.
Yeah, so that's how I met Randy, and so then.
Wait, you mean Randall Cook?
Oh, right. Thank you,
Randall William Cook.
Yes, Randall William Cook. Yes, yes. Hi, Randy.
Love you, Randy, and we're glad
love
you're here.
Yeah, well, love you.
He's very good.
I don't think he, I don't think he's one of the 40 either. So,
you know, he will be.
When it gets to be 50 or 60, then he'll be jealous that he wasn't one of a member of the 40.
How dare you?
Anyway, so then there was that whole side of the family. Anyway, so we did that. And then I hooked up with Tim Burton through
Rick
Chadwick, through Paul.
Okay.
And then he was finishing Pee-wee. And so I sort of got around all the Pee-wee thing. And then we were starting Beetlejuice.
But you know Rick Heinrichs then?
Very well.
Yeah, I mean.
Rick and I shared an office for.
Rick
and I also did, you know, Sleepy Hollow.
Together. Right, but not the one in Pasadena. You didn't share.
What do you mean, not? Yes. Rick,
the one above Stats?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Dave Fincher and I visited that before.
Oh, I God, thought. Yeah. Yeah, it was that all of the. Yeah. You mean Rick and living up in the and showering down the hall? And,
how the heck have we not met before? That's amazing.
It's pretty, yeah.
It's like, yeah. Like,
just, right. Yes.
It's all on purpose, Kirk. He was avoiding you.
I didn't know, and yet I knew.
Alan and Kirk started a podcast call, and Darren was left in the cold.
No. Yes.
Try it.
Don't mind us. Just reliving.
Tell me, Alan. So you worked on Beetlejuice. Amazing.
I supervised Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice is 2 years of my life. I designed and supervised and everything. Beetlejuice. I lived it.
Wow. So you know Vinil, and I mean I know tons of people that worked on that. I mean besides Rick and. Was Joe Ranft, did he work on that, or was he already at Pixar then?
No, he was already gone. But he was kind of in that.
That part, yeah.
There was this kind of, like, Henry, like, that's where I met Henry Selick, but he didn't work on it.
Met Henry Selick? Whoa.
You know, but Henry was sort of around then. Yeah, I don't know if you remember, there was a sculptor, Leo Rhine, who was.
No, I didn't know him.
Okay, because Leo when, you know, in terms of the, would we, because we were designing all the critters and all that kind of stuff, and Leo was kind of integral in that.
I met Leo on Monster House. He was our art department sculptor.
Yeah, he was great.
So the Kyoto brothers, you worked with them too, because they were did a lot of those stop motion stuff.
What?
Kyoto brothers. So you worked with them because they did all those stop motion stuff.
No, on Beetlejuice? No.
I thought they did.
Kyoto's, no, no. Doug Beswick did the Sandworm.
Yeah, yeah. For some reason, I thought
Doug was great. And Ted Ray did the snake, Beetlejuice snake stair.
Yeah, stair rail.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, that must have been a. Was it fun or was it like?
And do you know Tim Lawrence? Tim Lawrence did the replacement animation of the. That was Tim.
Wow.
And who else? Who else was around then? Steve Berg, obviously. Steve was. Steve and I built the sand planet, and
wow.
We actually rented out. We rented out triangle. Stages, so Steve could do the matte painting of the backing. He actually painted that himself.
Now, was it fun to work on? Was it chaos? Was Tim's?
No, it was the most hellish. I was. There was nothing left of me at the end of that.
Because of schedule, budget, both.
I mean, budget. There was nothing, but I had come from this world where you just did shit, right? Like there was no form, there was no anything to what you were doing, right? And then you're suddenly like on a real movie where they expect, you know, order.
Yeah.
And it just undid me.
Back then, Tim was pretty quiet. Like Tim was not like come in and direct. He was kind of quiet and sort of, a classic introvert. Was that frustrating because you didn't know what he wanted, or he was?
No. Tim was very conscious back then of the idea that the Tim Boy genius was this act that he sort of put on for the purpose of, you know, the executive. Right. That was this sort of part that, but as soon as, you know, all the real people, all the important people would leave, he would just go back to being Tim, which was fine. Yep. And, you know, was fun and interesting. And actually, on that front, the main reason the original, like how Tim sort of decided, like, yeah, I want you for the job and you're the man for this, is we shared a love for Carl Zeman movies.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Yes.
Carl. But we were sort of talking about,
he doesn't know.
You know, like I'd read the script and he was like, how do you see this? And I was like, well, I gotta tell you. Yeah, you know, it kind of reminds me of, you know, Baron Munchausen. And he was like, oh my God, you know this movie. And I was like, are you kidding? I mean, I love that stuff. And so then that became like the mantra of like, we're not trying to make it, you know, we're trying to make it interesting. You know, we just care that it's.
Well, Tim's art has a very, you know, a non-real look to it. It's very, I don't know, cartoony stylized.
Yes.
I think why it did so well, but when you're making it, the studio like, what the fuck are you guys like?
Oh my God! The first preview, we scored a 32.
Nice
preview. As a matter of fact, I remember I had been, you know, like at this point, I've been on the movie for like a year and a half, and two editor friends of mine. One of them actually, Steve Rivkin, who's ended up being Jim Cameron's main editorial, whatever, ever, right? Avatar and all those, whatever. Anyway, so I screened the movie. I showed the movie to Steve and another editor buddy, and they literally, when it ended, they turned to me and they said, "Alan, we're so sorry."
To me, I love the movie. I just thought it didn't really have an ending. It just kind of went, good night.
Good night. Yeah, well, that was
the song.
No, and then the amazing thing was, all right, so the movie's coming out and I'm on another gig. And then I get a call from one of the other people that had been on it, you know, forever, like the way I had been. And she called up and she said, you won't believe this. I'm down in Hollywood. And there's a line around the block and it's all kids and they're all dressed up.
Wow.
Like the characters, and we were like, how do they even
know? Right.
But somehow they knew, and it was like just
Clark,
utterly bizarre, just from out of nowhere.
Clark Hunter around.
So who?
Clark Hunter. He was part of the Rick Heinrichs, Tim Burton early days, one of the guys I lost touch with, but I didn't know if he worked on Beetlejuice.
Did
that get you a bunch of work? People like, oh my God. I mean, once it came out and was a hit, were people like, we want that Beetlejuice feeling? Or,
oh God, yeah. Well, then, you know, you just, after that, for a while, it became the, oh yeah, you're that guy that does that weird jet.
So,
but I realized there's actually yet a different connection, a whole that actually ties into the Beetlejuice thing, which is for a couple of years in there, on and off, I worked for a guy named Bob Rogers, who did he did like World's Fair movies. And so I used to do all these like crazy, those kinds of projects. And the thing about all of those projects was because you were making things for a specific venue. Right, you could do all these weird sort of interactive, and like we did a very famous show where it was all done with 45 degree mirrors, and you know, it was projected and you watched the whole show through mirrored glass, and things were appearing and disappearing, and it was all done as, so because of doing all that stuff, I had a kind of this grounding in live stage effects,
right.
You know, basically, you know, magic related stuff. And so the other thing that really intrigued Tim was the idea that I knew all these kooky ways to do things just in camera.
Okay.
And he was really, you know, so it's sort of like, you know, there's all this, there, you know, there's quite a few shots in the film where it could have, you know, it could have been composited, but it's not, it's actually done with like 45 degree mirrors. And, you know, we just did a lot of weird, I mean, there's hardly a shot in the film that's done twice the same way. I mean, every shot is just like its own weird ass, which is, by the way, which is ended up what kind of killed me off, was because it just becomes too much, you know, when you're trying to, you know, when you're trying to do five shots for a movie and you're kind of doing them all differently, it's fine. You know, when you're trying to do 500 and everyone is kind of like its own
thing. Yeah.
Thing, you got too much setup going on.
It was just like, you know, you just couldn't get to all of it. I mean, it was just, and there weren't very many of us. So it was just like me and, you know, a few other guys.
What was your credit on the movie? What credit?
Visual effects supervisor.
Okay. Yeah. So then, I mean, Darren told me that you worked on the Addams Family films with Sonnenfeld.
Oh, yes.
Were you effects supervisor on that? Or
I was effects supervisor and directed all the second unit.
I feel like working with Barry.
So you know Barry, don't you?
I hung out with Barry. We talked about wide-angle lenses.
Did you? Well, you got to make it wide. Right? Yeah.
I liked him. We got along.
No, yeah. Actually, Barry, you know, Barry, working with Barry and working with Tim, one of the things that it taught me is visually, I guess you would say visually, aesthetically, there are really only two kinds of people out there, two kinds of filmmakers you deal with. there are wall people and there are corner people.
Oh, interesting.
So Tim views the entire universe as flat plans. Yeah. So if you're lining up a shot for Tim, right, you'd be like this, flat to the wall, and people come and go. They go left to right.
Like
right,
the Flintstones.
This way, right?
Hanna-Barbera, yeah.
When you work for Barry, you are, everything is 45 into the corner, right?
No.
And things
depth
go away from you and towards you.
That's very true. And I love that you put it that way, because
and it turns out, like, actually, you know, when you work with people, you figure out that it's like, really, they're one or the other. They see the world as sort of like this flat.
Well, what's his name? Steve Zissou. The director is everything. I mean, that flat plane guy. And Barry, I mean, Barry and I talked about wide angle lenses because of exactly that Z depth. And I definitely, in fact, my editor told me that in a different way. He said, I was doing my first Muppet movie and he'd worked with Brian Henson. He goes, Brian likes things, like you just said, flat, kind of sees the world kind of more as a proscenium. And he goes, you are always on the bias. You're always on an angle. And I'm like, oh, interesting. And I just thought it's a taste thing, but that's funny that you put it. That's very cool. So yeah, I can see that. Absolutely.
Very cool. I'm not going to top that. Good night, everybody.
All right. Ladies
Thanks,
and gentlemen.
Everybody.
Alan and his twin brother, Monroe.
So, yes.
That's very cool. So, and when did you get into directing? Or production design, or whatever the other,
whatever it is.
I have the same problem, man. And people interview me like, "Well, what do you do? It's easier. Yeah.
This stuff." Okay. Well, yeah. I guess the biggest design thing, though. Yeah. I used to do a lot of it for, a lot of creature design and stuff for a lot of really shitty, 80s sci-fi stuff, you know, has my, you know, handprints all over them. Anyway, at that time, because I was part of it, kind of in that world too, of like, the foam latex universe.
Yeah, know it well.
So we got I got a call, and there was a movie at, this is, how did this work? Okay, so I did all the storyboards for Beetlejuice.
Oh, okay.
First frame to last, ordered the entire film, right? Because that was kind of what originally I was brought on to do, was, you know, like, not only board it, but kind of start working on the idea of how you would do these things, right? Okay. But then it became the boards were done, and they kind of went off to sort of like get a cast and finance. So we kind of went down on Beetlejuice for a while. And during that time, got a phone call. There was this film with this weird Austrian bodybuilder, Arnold Schwarzenegger, a movie called Hunter. And they'd boss had been down there working on it, and they pulled the plug on the whole thing. They were shooting in Mexico, and the whole thing had been a big F up. And they were out of money, and they needed to rethink the whole thing that they were doing. This is Fox, okay. So a few of us came on and reimagined, redesigned, re-everything what became Predator. And they then we essentially built a reel of like sort of animation boards and designs and everything. And then they took the pieces of the film that they already shot, and they cut this together, and they showed it to the executives at Fox. And they were like, oh my God, yes, we'll finance the rest of this movie. And
wasn't it originally like Jean-Claude Van Damme or something?
That was in the boss, the original boss.
Yeah, yeah, because I'd seen
version, but it was like a big frog.
Yeah, yeah. And then
it needed like this to basically to walk in around, there was like, they needed an overhead gantry, and nobody had thought about the fact you're in the fucking Mexican jungle and how is this going to work? And, you know, after all these, you know, X number of days, they had gotten exactly, you know, I think, you know, two shots of a frog going, it was like the Gorn, but, you know, not so,
yeah.
Not so good with that. It was the Gorn without the lifelike animation.
I'd seen stills from it, and then friends worked on it, but they worked on the new version of the Predator in your story. Yeah. Steve Wang and those guys, Shannon Shea.
Yeah, Shannon. Well, Shannon was actually the person that sort of was the first one to sort of publicly announce my role in actually Predator being Predator. And
oh, nice. Shannon's great.
That you know, famously, Stan always told the story of, you know, that the jaws were, you know, that was a Jim Cameron inspiration on a plane flight, and he'd always, you know, but no, it was like designed that long before. And actually, by the way, my design for the and why I did it, right, was based on an old Outer Limits episode with William Shatner, where I don't know if you remember it, Cold Hands one. Or no, which one is it? No, it's not the William Shatner.
It's not Shatner, no.
But there's an episode of Outer Limits where the creature is, his head is the two thumbs, and its tentacles it's literally a guy in a glove. Right.
I know what
so we were thinking about how to do this, right? So we thought, well, you know, if you build out the head and then you just had a guy that he could, you know, like do the right?
Right.
So that was actually the origination of the design was gonna work, and find somebody with a really skinny head.
And so you got Jean-Claude Van Damme fired.
Yes, and yeah, because anyway, it was a big conceptual rethink, because it was originally that he was, the kind of the original conception was that he was a, like a trophy hunter, right? And we sort of reconceived, but that didn't make a lot of sense for, like, if he can just kill them, why doesn't he just effing kill them, right?
Right.
And so it all got reconceived as, what if this is actually, like, he's sort of like a Maasai warrior, and this is like a rite of passage, like, oh, he's like a, he's actually not like, you know, he's like a teenager, right? And they send you out to go become a man, and so how you do this is you sort of have to
kill a badass,
kill it with just your bare hands and a laser gun or whatever we decided. Okay. But we kind of rethought, so that became sort of like the new basis, and that's actually where the dreadlocks and all that come from.
Oh, is now
because he was supposed to be like this. Kind
were
of
you involved African. With the writers at all, or I mean, was this just
no? It was just why don't we, you know, what about this, and what about that, and that makes more sense. One of the funniest changes in all of this, by the way, that I was always like, it's ridiculous. In the original script, okay, how it worked is that. The hunter, who will become Predator, but then it was still Hunter. They don't know what's going on. They're fighting this invisible thing, right? And the Arnold character grabs it, you know, in this sort of mono a mono, and so he's having it out with this invisible thing, and they fall off the edge of this cliff, and they go sliding down the mud and into a big mud hole. And when he pops up, so does this creature, and that was the big reveal. The big mudslide was actually about, you now see the creature because now he's covered in mud. So right. You finally see him. And they ended up in the, if you know the film at all, they reversed it. And they said, right. You know, Arnold now slides into the mud and the mud suddenly somehow makes him invisible. Right.
To kills his heat signature. I thought that was clever. Yeah.
So, oh, you do you? Mm-hmm. Well,
way better than the idea of coating way him better with chocolate. Than the idea.
Well, of course, that was a better idea.
Well, it could have been a win-win. It could have been you saw the creature, and then he couldn't see Arnold. I mean, it could have been, but why not both, as the kids
yes, say. Exactly. Exactly. Well, see, and that my you know, my whole thing at that point was, well, if we're not going to do that gag, if we're not going to do this for the big reveal, right? I don't understand. Why is he invisible in the first place? I mean, why don't we just like ditch the whole, well, because it doesn't, it actually always became this weird, like, you right. know, if what, like, okay, he's invisible, but why?
Right.
You know, well, like it doesn't seem to have a lot to do with the, you know, like any scenario that has to do with he's out like hunting these things. And I don't know.
So they can use all the B-roll of the jungle and not have to do anything.
It was kind of more about, by the way, the invisibility effect, which was Joel Hynek.
Mm-hmm.
Very great guy, by the way. He's still out there. If he's number 41.
That's right.
37 or something.
Well, you missed the episode when we were talking about his dad.
Yeah, well, no, and I was going to say, and
Ray Allen.
Then that gets you to the whole UFO.
Now you've got my interest, Alan. were you so McTiernan's directing it? Was he the original director, and then they brought?
Yes, but he wasn't any. You know, he was just this guy who'd fucked up. He'd gone off to Mexico and fucked this whole thing up. Right.
Right. So were you? He
wasn't John McTiernan yet?
Right. Were you interacting with him? Were you interacting with
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So and meeting with him, and you were effects supervisor, or you were creature?
No. We were just, it was myself, Mitch Suskin, a guy named Bob Short.
And, oh, Bob Short, I know. Yeah.
Yeah. No, Bob, I know very well.
You were just a team of cleaners that
yes,
were brought
we
down.
Were just, it was just the cleanup on aisle six crew.
Okay. So like, we got to fix this. And who brought you in?
Mitch Suskin. They had brought on Mitch, and then Mitch hired me, and Mitch hired Bob.
As a production manager, or what did they bring him in as the fixer?
I don't know what he was. I don't know what his official title was. That's what I mean. We were just like, hey, so we're
need help.
Like, okay, sure. What are we gonna, you know, like? And then so you did start drawing and like scribbling out scenes, and how about this, and what about that, and
I've been there.
You know, just doing drawings of what could this thing be, and then we were kind of all talking about like you know, it was all related around the idea of what could we do that was cool that hadn't been done, that you could do cheaply, and you could literally go just kind of take it on the road and take some guys out and you could go friggin' do this. And
yeah,
and we did this whole thing. He was going to have, you know, back bent legs, and we built these little, you know, like wooden mock-up legs and all kinds of stuff.
Crazy.
It didn't happen, but it was a lot of that.
They used that in Invaders from Mars.
So.
Did remember the, well, the Stan Winston one, they had the backwards legs thing that they did.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Or Stan. Stan's my oddly enough, so I had always these sort of odd collisions connections with Stan. I, you know, knew him, but I didn't know him well. He was always nice enough to anyway, but he kind of ended up doing all these things that I started on, and but then he sort of magically showed up and was doing them.
A lot of credit.
So then cut to, it's now Oscar night of whatever, 92 or 93. And the Academy calls me and they say, we would like Thing to be one of the presenters. on the Academy Awards.
Thing from the Addams Family.
Thing from the Addams Family. Okay. And so I'm like, sure, we can figure this out. And so we rig one of the puppets, and it turns out we're doing this. We're setting up this gag for the makeup, best makeup award. Mm. Okay. And so how this worked is set up on the other, the far side of the stage, set the gag up. They went to a commercial, crossed the stage during the commercial. They give you a minder, by the way. So we set it up off stage, and then, okay, they go to commercial, and then I'm walking across stage. So I'm out in the middle of the stage, Academy night, and I sort of do my obligatory pause and turn to the audience. And wow. And I hear behind me the guy go, they saying, knock it off. Okay. So go to the other side. So the way the gag worked is that Thing was pulling a wagon, and the wagon had the envelope. And it came over, and Chris Lloyd was, and Rebecca De Mornay from Runaway Train, they were the two presenters. And he would take the envelope from Thing and read it.
Thank you, Thing.
Yeah, right? Okay. So gag comes off perfect. And we were, Dave Miller and I, we were standing off stage getting ready. And how this worked is after he announced, and the winner is, I ran up on stage, grabbed the wagon and Thing, and ran back down the stairs and got out of the shot before the shot comes back around, right? Because it's on the winners. So I'm, you know, kind of all in my, you know, ready to run up. And I'm standing there, and he says, and the winner is Stan Winston. And I couldn't decide whether I should just trip him on the way down, or I should just run up and instead of grabbing Thing, just
grab
the Oscar and tell everybody, thank you. And you don't know how much I appreciate this moment.
Oh God, Stan would have pulled out a knife.
Yeah. And so didn't do damn it.
We've got a time limit, I think.
Yeah. Uh-oh. I want to ask you to come back and finish this because we're only like a third through your career.
Great. You're going to make our lives so much easier. We'll just do
really three. Because you can, I can just,
and maybe next time we can figure out a way to get you on the real recording.
Was going to say, oh, in the meantime, I'll figure out what in the hell is going on with
Mark. Fine.
Well, because, you know, look, you did a better job getting here than Stan Winston did.
Exactly. So, where's Stan? Huh?
So there you go.
What's Stan's excuse?
Tough room. I don't tell you.
Huh?
Alan, thank you so much for spending some time with us this morning. I really appreciate it. Maybe next time we can talk about how we actually met, which is
kind of fun. Yeah, we were kind of just.
I was enraptured. I didn't know all this Golden Globus stuff.
Really?
And I'm glad I learned it, because now I can be a little more careful around you.
Danny, and Great Race, and he did Mad World, and
yeah,
Danny was the man. He was amazing.
Yeah. Well,
I haven't thought about Danny in years. And his wife was out there.
Stop thinking about it.
It's an honor and pleasure to meet you. And I am absolutely shocked.
And you?
Run across each other in the billion years we've both been doing.
Doing this.
Yeah.
And so finally it happened.
Let's do a part two here. Definitely.
All righty.
Yeah, let's figure it out. Thanks so much. I appreciate
you. Thank you, everyone, for listening. He's interesting. We're having him back.
And now we're up to 45.
Really?
Well, five? I'm hoping. I'm only projecting. Hopefully, we'll add at least five.
Oh, we don't know.
I promise to deliver at least 100 viewers within the next year.
Alan Munro, thank you for joining us on the Weirded Beardos. See you next time.